Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, VOR listeners. Welcome to the inaugural broadcast of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager. This 1 hour per week will be devoted to subjects that are deemed out of bounds or too hot to handle on every other broadcasting network I know of that reaches a fairly general audience. Let me give you the definition of heretic in case some are not sure about it. The dictionary definition of heretic is a person who holds unorthodox opinions. To be orthodox is to adhere to an accepted or established doctrine. So you can expect to hear unorthodox opinions in the next hour, but they will always be backed up with fact and verifiable information to the best of my ability. Free speech allows free and open discussion of all historical events and religious beliefs, and that is well and good. But opinions that are not backed up with facts, with solid reasoning, with common sense, are not worth much. During the course of these programs, we'll be examining many of these opinions and beliefs about history that have been forced, in one way or another, on various population groups around the world, in light of current research, factual knowledge, and common sense. Sometimes, I'll have an expert guest on with me. Always, we have on board our producer and technician, Mike Connor, and he might have something to say now and then. I might even ask him to say something, like right now. How about it? Could you say something, Mike?
Sure, Carolyn. How are you today?
Well, I'm well. I'm excited about this.
Thanks for coming on the network. We're glad to have you on.
Well, thank you. Okay, I guess you don't want to talk too much right now, so maybe we'll get you to say more later. Tonight, there are two breaking stories that deserve our attention. But before I get to those, I want to comment on a remarkable development that has taken place in Israel. The Knesset, Israel's parliament, has just passed a new law making it a crime to show signs of sadness and mourning on the 15th of May, which is the day the Jews, or if you prefer, the Zionists, celebrate the creation of the Zionist state, which occurred in 1948. Why would the only democracy in the Middle East, as they call themselves, pass such an undemocratic law, regulating what kind of emotions its citizens can express? Well, it's because Palestinians mark that day as a day of mourning, because that is when their dispossession by the Zionists began. That's the day the terror against them began, what they call the Nabka, meaning the catastrophe, which is still ongoing after 62 years. Obviously, it offends the ruling majority to see sorrow on the faces of the Arab Israelis, and also a few sane, sympathetic Jewish Israelis, who cannot possibly feel joy or celebrate their own dispossession, murder, theft of their property, and loss of their homeland. Yet the ruling Israelis expect them to do just that, because it is their Independence Day. Hebrew radio reported that the law was intended to stop commemorative acts that, it is claimed, are tantamount to denying the Jewish character of Israel and insulting the symbols of the state. It also said the fines might amount to up to 3 times the expenditure of the commemorative programs. Let's think about that charge of denying the Jewish character of Israel and insulting the symbols of the state. If that doesn't sound incredibly like the way Jews describe National Socialist Germany, I don't know what does. Can't you hear them? It goes like this. The Nazis insisted on the German character of Germany and expected all to revere and even worship the symbols of the state, which took the place of former religious symbols. It was racism, state fascism, and terror, pure and simple. Isn't that how they talk? What an awful place Germany was when it expected a German character to prevail. The irony here is so rich it amounts almost to burlesque. And, of course, the similarity to the Jewish Shoah is unmistakable. Here you have Jews, and particularly Israel, for the past 65 years insisting on heavy-duty mourning for their own catastrophe and are not satisfied with themselves being able to commemorate and mourn, but force by every means possible the rest of the world to commemorate and mourn also. We know they discourage the commemoration of the catastrophes of other peoples, but now they are going even further and outlawing in their own state the commemoration of the catastrophe of the non-Jews there. Well, we know why, of course. It's because they caused it. They were the perpetrators. But no one is supposed to say that. They deny it. They deny they did anything wrong. Here you have a close comparison that can be made. 62 years ago, the catastrophe of the Palestinians began, a catastrophe for which most of the rest of the world uses the term genocide. It's still ongoing, so the Israeli genocide of the Palestinians has been taking place for 62 years now. But the Israeli government doesn't want their Arab citizens to commemorate this anniversary within the borders of their state. In contrast, the catastrophe of the Jews, which they call their Shoah, lasted 4 years officially, and the world didn't even see it, as we saw and see the Palestinian catastrophe. Yet Jews everywhere force their commemorations on those around them who are not Jews and don't really share their feelings of mourning, but too bad. In other words, Israeli Jews are offended by those who are expressing feelings different from their own about their Independence Day celebrations in their presence. They don't want to be confronted by it, and therefore they outlaw it. But these same Israeli Jews are also offended if, well, let's just use the example of Germany, but the same goes for all Western and Eastern European nations. If German nationals should want to commemorate a day or event in their history which Jews do not approve of, their capacity to be offended is prodigious. They are offended in their own land, and they are offended in everyone else's land also. And then they are doubly offended when they are accused of wanting to run the world. It seems that is the only logical conclusion an honest witness can come to. This act, this law the Israeli legislature has passed, reveals in perfect form how the Jewish mind operates, of which I will have more to say toward the end of this program. Now let's move on to the good news that Ernst Sundel, that notorious anti-Semite, was released from bondage today after 7 years in the prisons of the Orthodox establishment. And according to an AP Newswire story, was met by a crowd of 20 supporters who clapped and shouted bravo as he emerged from the steel gates of the prison in Mannheim. I would like to call this a liberation. Many, many of the prisoners who were liberated from the concentration camps of Germany had been convicted of crimes far more serious than Mr. Sundel's, but they are considered to have been unjustly incarcerated by a criminal, illegitimate regime. Mr. Sundel is photographed holding bouquets of flowers handed to him by some of his supporters. He said, "I'm back out after 7 years, 3 weeks, 3 prisons, and 3 countries. He declined to comment when an eager reporter asked him whether the Holocaust happened. He said, "It's kind of a sad situation. There's a lot to say. I'd certainly be careful not to offend anyone and their draconian laws." Sundel gave no details about his future plans, saying only that he wanted to improve his health and would return to his home region in the Black Forest. And here's a quote from him, according to the AP story. "Having spent the last 7 years in a chicken coop, I've gained a lot of weight. I have to lose that. I have to get checked out in a hospital." Among those waiting for him was Lady Michelle Renouf and his 87-year-old attorney, who drove him away in a private car. It's reported Lady Renouf handed her cell phone to Zundel in the car to say a few words to his wife, Ingrid. The article goes on to say, one of Zundel's lawyers on Monday criticized the 5-year sentence in Germany as having been too severe, saying there had been a lack of justice due to the fact that the Holocaust is a sensitive subject in Germany. I'm happy that he made it, attorney Alexandra Ritterhaus said. It was a hard and frustrating time, that's putting it mildly, during which she said, that is Ritterhaus said, he was initially not allowed to receive all of some 1,700 letters because officials feared it would threaten his resocialization. Yeah, that's the way they do it. They read your letters, and if there's a if the letters contain things that are not politically correct in their estimation, then they don't allow the prisoners to have them because it might, you know, they're trying to revamp their mental their mental thoughts. It goes on to say supporters outside the prison called Zundel a brave man and a victim of justice. While some maintain there still, now listen to this, some maintain there still was no evidence that anyone was gassed to death at Nazi concentration camps during World War II. Well, good for them. They're trying to put that out and get it into the AP article, and they did. Even though we're happy today, we can't forget that they kept this law-abiding man locked up for 7 years. Much of it spent in high-security solitary confinement. His crime was to exercise his free speech in the dissemination of facts and common sense regarding the Holocaust, spelled with a capital T and a capital H. Zundel was given a prison sentence as a high-security risk by the Federal Republic of Germany. But the caper was made possible by the collaboration of the United States and Canada. What are Ernst Zundel's chances of enjoying the blessings of free speech, freedom of movement and association, and other such freedoms that we in America take for granted, now that he served every minute of his sentence without being given probation? Very slim. Such is the power of establishment orthodoxy in the Western world. And in case anyone is still not sure, Zundel is a heretic in our society, and therefore doesn't deserve the blessings of democracy. But to me, and I hope to many of you, Ernst Zundel is not only a heretic, he is a hero, in capital letters. For more information about Ernst Zundel, go to www.zundelsite.org, not .com, .org, and while you're there, look at the products to buy, books and tapes, to help Ingrid Zundel with legal costs. You can also go to www.revisionist.com to read an excellent profile of Ernst Zundel, his life and accomplishments to date, with photographs written by Mark Weber. On that page, go down to the bottom of the page, it's got alphabetical listings, to the Z, and click on Ernst Zundel. We will be watching for news about Ernst's prospects now that he has been set free in the Federal Republic of Germany police state. There might not be much information about him for a while because he will have to behave himself very carefully, and I don't know what plans they have. I know he understands what is up against him and how he will function. I really don't know. As far as I know right now, he doesn't have much chance of getting out of Germany. So I'll now turn my attention to one of the most celebrated upholders of the established orthodoxy, one who publicly demands punishment and prison sentence for heretics, one who has zero sympathy for any German in particular, which our friend Ernst Zundel happens to be, and for full disclosure purposes, I am also, as a third-generation German-American who traces her ancestors prior to the beginning of the 18th century to the same area that Ernst Zundel was born in. This celebrated upholder of orthodoxy is none other than Elie Wiesel. First, I want to make it very clear that the name weasel is pronounced weasel, with the accent on the first syllable, not weasel, which is completely incorrect, but one of those previously mentioned beliefs that are forced upon an unwilling, unknowing populace. Even Bradley Smith pronounces Ellie's name as weasel, I suppose for the same accommodating reasons, because that's how Ellie pronounces his name. But here on the Heretics Hour, we are sticklers for accuracy, and the name will be pronounced weasel, or weasel, which is even more correct. Incidentally, weasel is German for, yes, that sneaky little animal that no one likes, the weasel. Almost everyone knows who Elie Wiesel is. He is the world's most famous Holocaust survivor, who has authored many books. The best known, the one that is always mentioned in connection with him, is Night. Night is a book that is assigned to high school and college classes studying the Holocaust. Elie is also the founder of the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, which raises money to be used to promote Holocaust consciousness around the globe. He is a recipient of every prestigious award you can think of, including the Nobel Peace Prize, given to him for his book Night, by the way. Elie is also a professor at Boston University, where he holds the Andrew Mellon Professorship of Humanities. Where did Wiesel get the education that enables him to hold such an academic position? He has none. Nowhere on Wiesel's Wikipedia page is there any mention of his education. His life experience is obviously credited to him in lieu of formal education. So it's clear that Elie Wiesel is a very privileged person indeed. But it's not what is known about Elie Wiesel that I'm going to talk about with you tonight. It's what is not known, or not known until just recently. Because just last week, a new research piece about Wiesel was posted on the well-known by the well-known and truly distinguished writer, the Italian Carlo Mattonio, on the Inconvenient History Revisionist blog, which you can access with the URL revblog.codoh.com. I'm going to go into Mattonio's background later if I have time, but you can read about him at the revisionist at the same revisionist.com website I recommend for Ernst Zundel, and at the Carlo Mattonio webpage at www.vho.org/authors. You will notice that it is way, way, way more impressive educationally than Wiesel's. Okay, what Carlo Mattonio documents, let's remember that word documents. This is a verb form. And to document something means to present the original documents of the time in question and allow others to see them, or so that others can see them. And this is Elie Wiesel's entire identity as a survivor of Auschwitz-Buchenwald and the author of the book Night that has been stolen from another person. Yeah, this is what Carlo Mattonio has documented, that Elie Wiesel is shown to be a complete fraud as to the life experience that his entire reputation is built on. He is not only a phony, he is a thief. You know, Elie Wiesel is now outed as one of the worst specimens of humanity imaginable. This man who founded the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity. The irony is really rich. This is quite an accomplishment that Carlo Mattonio has brought about for us. But before we go into that, let's begin by taking a close look at Elie Wiesel's history as it appears on his Wikipedia page. He was born on September 30th, 1928, in Siget, a little town in Transylvania, now Romania. He claims to be Hungarian. In 1944, when he was 16 years old, he, his parents, and three sisters were moved to one of two ghettos in Siget. Now, I don't know if that's pronounced properly. I don't know Hungarian. But I'm calling the town that he lived in Siget, spelled S-I-G-H-E-T. In May, the Jews of Siget were deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau. It was there that he has always claimed to that he received the prisoner number A7713, and it was tattooed on his left arm. I want to point out here that Wiesel, unlike most Auschwitz-Birkenau survivors with tattoos, who willingly, even eagerly, show their tattoos as proof of their victimhood, Ellie refuses to reveal his tattoo, based on some claim of modesty, even though he is a spokesman for these victims. According to Ellie Wiesel, he and his father were 3 weeks in Auschwitz before they were assigned to work at Auschwitz III, called Monowitz, at the Buna factory. This would have been in a quarantine section where all newly arriving prisoners were put to make sure they weren't carrying any infectious diseases. Once they were settled in Monowitz to work at the factory, they remained there until January 1945. At that time, they chose to abandon the camp with the Germans, according to Ellie Wiesel, and were sent to Buchenwald concentration camp near Weimar, Germany. Wiesel never gives an exact date for their arrival at Buchenwald. However, there is no record of Ellie Wiesel ever being at Buchenwald, or at Auschwitz-Birkenau, Monowitz for that matter. Nor has he ever given an exact date for his deportation to or his arrival at Auschwitz-Birkenau. In fact, the vague and roundabout way he writes of it, as described by Matonio, brings him there around June 7, 1944. Yet the transport from Siget, which he supposedly was on, left on May 20th and arrived at Birkenau on May 24th. This is just one example of Ellie Wiesel's, mistakes that he makes, and also the vagueness in which he writes about everything, which is another indication that makes you one question whether he was ever there. You know, when a witness cannot describe with any detail, and when what he does say is incorrect, then you have to conclude that he didn't know. He doesn't know because he wasn't there. Well, that's just common sense. But now we have the documents also. So to continue with the story, a person who is documented to have arrived at Birkenau from Siget is a man named Lazar Wiesel, whose birth date was September 3rd, 1913, making him 15 years older than Ellie Wiesel. Lazar Wiesel was given the tattoo number A7713, the number Ellie claims as his own. This is all written on Lazar Wiesel's official file card from Buchenwald, which Matonio has produced and has published on the RevBlog website. It also states the names of his father and mother, which just happen to be the same as Wiesel's parents' names, including his mother's maiden name. From this, it's clear that Ellie Wiesel has taken his Holocaust survivor identity from Lazar Wiesel. No one had looked closely enough at Ellie's credentials until a year ago, when a Hungarian man who had emigrated to Australia after the war came forward with an accusation that Ellie Wiesel was an imposter and that his book Night was stolen from his old concentration camp friend, or from this man's old concentration camp friend, Lazar. This man's article was published on a Hungarian website and then picked up by Henry Macau on his Canadian website, henrymacau.com. I read it at the time, and I was intrigued by it, as many people were. There was quite a bit of talk about it. But how to know if this Hungarian man was telling the truth? This survivor's name is Miklos Gruner. Matonio has posted with his article a copy of a concentration camp inmates questionnaire of the military government of Germany, filled out for Miklos Gruner, giving his date of birth as 6 April 1928, the same year as Ellie Wiesel, establishing that he was at Buchenwald in May 1945. So this is proof that Miklos Gruner is the person he says he was, that he was at Buchenwald, that he, when it was liberated in May 1945. This is more than we have for Elie Wiesel. Nicholas Gruner was deported, according to him, with other Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz in May 1944, where he and his father and older brother were put to work at Monowitz at the IG Farben synthetic fuel factory. This is the same as the Buna factory. After 6 months, his father died, and his brother was transferred to another camp. This left Miklos without any family of his own there with him. Being only 15 or 16 years old at the time, two Jewish friends of his father took Miklos under their protection. Their names were Abraham and Lazar Wiesel, brothers. In January, the three of them joined the trek from Auschwitz to Buchenwald, partly by train, partly on foot, during which time Abraham Wiesel, the older of the two brothers, died. Miklos and Lazar remained at Buchenwald until the camp was liberated on April 8, 1945. After that, they were separated when Miklos was sent to a tuberculosis clinic in Switzerland and later emigrated to Australia. Miklos' brother, who also survived, settled in Sweden. Fast forward to 1986. Miklos Gruner receives an invitation from a Swedish magazine to travel to Sweden to meet his old concentration camp buddy, Elie Wiesel. When he doesn't recognize the name, he's told it's the same person as his friend Lazar Wiesel, with the number A7713. Miklos recognizes the number and gladly goes to Sweden, expecting a reunion with his old friend and protector. He is shocked to find Elie there masquerading as number A7713. Wiesel refused to show Gruner his tattoo, but he did give him a copy of his famous book, Night, about his experiences as prisoner, A7713, at Auschwitz and his transfer to Buchenwald. This was a mistake on Ellie's part because Miklos Gruner then began researching both Wiesel and the book. He discovered it was written by his friend Lazar using the name Elazar Wiesel in 1955 in the Hungarian language and published in Paris under the title A Világ Hallgat, which means in Hungarian, which I don't speak, and so I probably didn't pronounce that right, and the world remained silent. Now, Metonio could find no record of this book in Hungarian, but there is a record of the same book in Yiddish with the title Und die Welt hat geschwiegen, which in Yiddish means approximately The World Kept Silent. The author is Elazar Wiesel, published in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1955, 252 pages long. Wiesel asserts to have written it in 1954 while on a cruise in Brazil. However, in an interview, he declared that it was only in May of 1955, after an encounter with François Mauriac, a well-known French writer, that he decided to break his silence, that is, to tell his story as a Holocaust survivor. Miklos insists that his friend Lazar's book was then shortened and rewritten in French as well as in English in order to be published under the author's name, Elie Wiesel, in 1958, which is when the book, under the French title La Nuit and the English title Night, came out. He also makes the point that while Elie Wiesel has made a fortune on the book, selling 10 million copies, can you believe? And awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for it, the real author, the real prisoner whose number was A7713, had gone mysteriously missing. Gruner tells us that he receives death threats warning him not to continue to speak about this. When we think about it, we realize that he has nothing to gain personally. He has only trouble to bring on himself. It has to be about bringing out the truth and about friendship, loyalty, and a disgust with lying sleazeballs, don't you think? However, we can't say for sure about Gruner. We do know that he actually was in Auschwitz in Buchenwald. We know that Lazar Wiesel was actually in Auschwitz in Buchenwald. We know that there's not actually any any proof that Elie Wiesel was there, but we don't know for sure since the record of the book was not found in Hungarian but only in Yiddish. We cannot say yet for sure whether the book was written by Lazar Wiesel. But let's go over what I'm saying here. It could be that Elie Wiesel learned of Lazar Wiesel's book and thought it would be just the right thing to present as his own. And not only that, he is presenting Lazar's mother and father as his own too. And Lazar's hometown of Maro Mosziget as his own too. Maro Sziget is the same as what is now known simply as Sziget. So who is Elie Wiesel really? Well, he says he had three sisters. He was the only son. He says he and his father were separated from his mother and younger sister and his other sisters, I assume, at Birkenau and never saw them again. But what are the other two? Wikipedia says that Beatrice and Hilda survived the war and were reunited with Elie at a French orphanage. They all emigrated to North America, with Beatrice moving to Montreal, Canada. To take this further, according to an official Buchenwald file card, Lazar Wiesel's father was Shlomo Wiesel, his mother was Serena Feig, and they lived in Sziget, Romania, and were deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau in May 1945. Now, according to nothing but Elie Wiesel's word, no records for him, his father was Shlomo Wiesel, his mother was Sarah Feig, they lived in Sziget, Romania, and were deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau in May, or according to him, in June, which is wrong, 1945. So what do you believe? While you're thinking about this, it's time for our break. We're going to take a few minutes for a news break, and please continue listening, and I'll be with you on the other side. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Radovan Karadzic, the wartime leader of the Bosnian Serbs, has accused prosecutors in The Hague of fabricating the evidence used during his tribunal. The comments were made as his trial resumed on Monday. Karadzic faces 11 charges of war crimes, including genocide and crimes against humanity in connection with the Bosnian conflict, which left more than 100,000 people dead. The tribunal opened last October, but was suspended when Karadzic claimed he'd been denied enough time to prepare his defense. He also said that Richard Holbrooke, now the U.S. special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, promised him immunity from prosecution in exchange for abandoning power after the Bosnian War. That's been claimed, the claims rather, that Washington has denied. During his defense speech today, Karadzic gave a strong rebuke to the prosecutors.
It would appear that the prosecution has struck an agreement with our enemies in war, or as we like to say, without joking, that the prosecutor is trying to turn this tribunal into a disciplinary commission of NATO.
Well, Karadzic is accused of mass murder on a horrific scale, but in his homeland, his followers claim the Hague Tribunal is simply a kangaroo court where justice is unlikely to ever happen. RT's Paula Slea has been to meet those who still hail him as a hero.
Radovan Karadzic might be in The Hague, but for his fans back in his hometown of Pali, he's not that far away. The talk of the town is still about him, and while he's been tried by the West for war crimes, here he's the local hero who's been unfairly accused. Zoran Kostic met Karadzic in the early 70s at a poet festival in the then former Yugoslavia. He says history will judge him differently.
I don't doubt that Radovan will be successful in his defense because he has the truth on his side. When, in the history of law and civilization, was it forbidden to defend your people?
But for Dane Chunkovic, Radovan's trial is more than just one man standing in the dock. He believes the whole of the Republic of Srpska where Karadzic was president during the Bosnian war years, is on trial.
The tactics of Western governments and their allies is to accuse the Republika Srpska of genocide. If they can prove Radovan Karadzic is guilty, then they can prove that the Republika Srpska was founded on genocide. We know what the verdict of the Hague Tribunal will be. Guilty.
Danis collected thousands of signatures of Bosnian Serbs who are calling for a referendum to be held. They want the Republic of Srpska to be independent of Bosnia-Herzegovina and believe this is the only way they can guarantee their future.
For more than a decade, Radovan Karadzic has not stepped foot here in Pale, although his family still lives here. Overlooking the town is this building, which he used as his headquarters. From here, during the war, he commanded his efforts.
Photographs of their war hero still hang from the walls of this favorite local hangout. It's a place where Serbs come to relax and reflect on the glory of their past.
He's our Serbian leader, a positive person. He's far from being a criminal. He's a man that we all support. There's no reason for him to be in The Hague.
Every people here, every man support him in all ways because he's defending opinion of our people.
No one here expects Karadzic to get a fair deal in the Netherlands. They say his trial is just another example of the double standards of the West towards Serbia and the Serbian people. Polislia, RT, the Republic of Srpska.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I've been talking about Elie Wiesel and the fraud that he apparently has perpetrated on the world as a Holocaust survivor of Auschwitz and Buchenwald. And I asked you, before we went to the break, what did you believe about Elie as to who is telling you the truth here? Lazar Wiesel, was there a Lazar Wiesel? And did Elie Wiesel steal his identity? You know that many people confronted with this evidence will simply not believe it. That's why I'm bringing up this question of what do you believe? Because we find that no matter what we present, most people do not want to believe it. They will say, if that were true, it would have been found out long ago. He could not have won all those awards if he had not really been there. And they will just put it out of their minds. I want to tell you something that happened just the other night. I was having a phone conversation with a relative, a very good Christian person who lives in another state. The subject of Jewish deaths in the gas chambers came up, quite unexpectedly. I don't know if I've ever talked about that with her before. But I gave her the Bradley Smith challenge. I said, show me where one person has died from gas asphyxiation from being put into an alleged gas chamber meant to kill human beings in or by the Third Reich. It has never been shown, and no one has been able to do it. She said, how can you say the Jews weren't killed when they have film of people being herded into gas chambers? I said, what film? There is no film of gas chambers, period, let alone of people being herded into them. She insisted she had seen such film. I told her it must have been movie film, like Schindler's List, and was represented, or she thought she was seeing, film of real life. No, no, she cried. It was not Schindler's List. It was real people. I said, I can tell you flat out and swear on a stack of 10 Bibles, there is no such film and you did not see it. I don't know what you saw, but whatever it was shown in such a way as to make you believe you were seeing something that you weren't. There was a pause. I don't remember where I saw it, she said. Now, this relative does not have a computer, but that doesn't really matter, because many people who get news and spend time on the computer would be saying the same thing. But she gets her information from television, radio, newspapers, and magazines, and she goes to movies sometimes. Sometimes she reads a book. I'm not saying she doesn't read books, but I don't think she reads, she doesn't read books on history or about anything like this. She believes the story these sources, the television, radio, newspaper, and magazines, uniformly put out, even though she will admit, oh yes, they probably have, you know, different points of view, but she doesn't basically question that they're trying to put out accurate information. And she has no desire, therefore, or reason to question it. So she thinks she has seen photographic evidence of actual people in gas chambers. Such is the power of suggestion. Speaking a little bit about my personal interest in this, in the time that I have been reading, researching, and learning about many kinds of hoaxes and frauds, not just the Holocaust, but as far as the Holocaust goes, I'm interested in the frauds, meaning the people who are frauds involved in it, the well-known ones. Because we have the evidence, or we have proven the non-evidence of the gassing claims. We have proven all the that all the atrocity claims are basically lies. They're war propaganda that just was not allowed to die down, was not repudiated. But what we're left with that we have not really tackled well enough are the stars, what I call the stars, in quotes. The big names like Wiesenthal, Spielberg. It might sound like I am using too strong language about these people in this event, but I want to put it in perspective this way. Holocaust liars pose too great a peril to be an object of pity or compassion, or even of understanding. We must help people to get over feeling sorry for them and attributing their propensity to lie to damage done to their personalities by the horror they experienced. This is nonsense. Anyone truly living through terror or unfairness or humiliation becomes more honest, not less. These people wield a weapon of mass destruction, which is their ability to write books, make films, and speak to the public, especially to vulnerable young people. Look at all the damage Elie Wiesel has done. I have written about Irene Zisblatt, who is doing the same thing, although she is not at all in the category of an Elie Wiesel. And it is not just that they are able to write books, make films, and speeches, but that they are believed, almost no matter what they say. The population is conditioned to believe them. They have been given an unearned aura of respectability. But when we look closely at their past, take the time to really search and find the necessary documents, we invariably find a lot of embarrassing facts, a lot that they are hiding. It's really necessary to push on these embarrassing facts, including evidence of fraud, and not let the issues go to sleep again, that is, die down and become just sort of silent. I have reason to believe that there will be more coming out on Elie Wiesel. In any case, his history is still being looked into. But we have enough already to do huge damage to the Holocaust industry. You may or may not be aware that Simon Wiesenthal was exposed as a liar by a British historian some months ago, but his worldwide organization is still functioning and respectable. That is, the people who run it are still quoted in the news as experts and human rights activists. Why? Well, because Wiesenthal was presented as a flawed man, but one whose good work made up for his personal failings, and perhaps was even due to them. Yes, didn't they say he was a showman, and by being that, he was able to bring attention to a global problem, that of the failure to prosecute low-level ex-Nazis, as though that has benefited the world one iota. It is solely Jewish revenge and nothing more. But somehow being a liar or telling lies goes along with being the showman that he was, which caused him to be the kind of personality that would bring attention to a problem, that of the ex-Nazis roaming around the world and that had not yet been prosecuted, that needed attention. And the same, I'm sure, is going to be done when this new, you know, to resist this information about Elie Wiesel. So I say it's time to prosecute Holocaust frauds and thieves like Wiesel and Zisblatt and Spielberg and many others. We should go after them the way the Wiesenthal Center has gone after ex-Nazis. We don't have the power of the press, but we do have the facts on our side. We begin right now with Elie Wiesel, and we think of him just the way the Nazi hunters thought of Adolf Eichmann, as public enemy number one. Yes, this is what it has to be. Public enemy number one of our community. A concerted effort to capture and put on trial in our own internet media these enemies of the public good. Now, I'm not trying to rouse up a movement here. I'm not using this forum to create, to call for actions of that of any particular nature. I'm only saying that when you have evidence like this that has come up with about Elie Wiesel, we really need to use this. We need to make the most of it. I would ask you to go to that website, revblog.coda.com, revblog.coda.com, and copy Carlo Mutonio's article there and paste it to your blogs, send it to others' blogs, send it to forums, send it to everyone you know. Talk about it and have the necessary outrage to overwhelm the protests of those who are going to seek to defend him or to minimize this. Just think how much outrage the Jews use against anyone and everyone who has any connection at all to what they term the Holocaust or the Shoah, their great new religion. We have the right to use the same level of outrage for the frauds that they have perpetrated against our people and against truth, and we should use it. This is a gigantic fraud perpetrated by Elie Wiesel, one which everyone can understand and no one can condone. Now to some words about the mystique of lying. It is a worthy subject in itself. I started working on an article some weeks ago, but haven't been able to continue with it since because of other priorities. But its working title is The True Legacy of the Holocaust, Conflating of Lies with Truth. In it, I want to explore this disregard for truth, also for facts, logic, consistency, that is found everywhere in the writings of Holocaust defenders and so-called historians. Why is it so easy for them to lie? Why doesn't their conscience bother them or even cause them to fear being found out? They don't even seem to care when they are found out. They just tell more lies to explain it away. This is what I call a phenomenon. It creates a climate of acceptance of lying by turning it into something that leads to a higher good. Can lies be good and good for the people in a democracy? Can political lies be good? Can lies about a particular ethnic group ever play a part in promoting tolerance and peace among nations? What is a lie? How do we determine it? Does it depend on who is saying it? It's my conviction that those who uphold the Holocaust have no trouble lying, and that's because, pardon me for saying this, but they're mostly Jews, and Jews have a very different attitude to truth and falsehood than Western Europeans do. I say Europeans rather than non-Jews because I can't speak for all non-Jewish groups. The Jewish religion of formal Judaism and the Zionist religion or movement or cause both allow and even bless lies that are told to non-Jews if that will in some way benefit Jews. Okay, not all Jews follow this practice. I want to be sure you hear me say this, but that is still the teaching. The world was created for the Jew, and all things that benefit the Jew are good, and everything that harms the Jew is bad. This is supposedly what God told them. In the case of the Zionists, it's simply the best way to proceed. So what I'm saying is that the tendency to lie, yea, the propensity for lying, has been inculcated into the Jew with his religious training and with his political education and with his membership in Hebrew society. There is a new movie out, the name of which is Defamation. It's available free on the internet, and if you haven't seen it yet, you need to find it and watch it. It's possible I might talk about it next week. In this movie, you see lies being stated everywhere, but the people saying them don't think they're lies. They have no ability to distinguish between truth and lie, for the most part. There is a Jewish tour guide at the concentration camp Majdanek who is telling a ridiculous atrocity story about the camp commandant that he most likely knows is a lie, but it doesn't bother him a bit. And he's telling it to high school students. So the idea of lie is an interesting concept to investigate. Is it a strategy only, or is it a way of thinking, a way of perceiving reality, a brainwave pattern, or perhaps some of that or all of that? I think you can see what I'm getting at. Why do Jews lie so easily, so consistently, so compulsively? And are they inculcating that trait into the societies they dominate? The Holocaust is based on lying witnesses, lying because they choose to lie or were coerced into it, and by its acceptance into European societies and its enforcement as an article of faith, are these societies taking on the same pattern of conflating truth with falsehood and mixing them up as we find in all Jewish communities? By accepting Elie Wiesel as a high priest of human rights and a man of peace and justice, by accepting the Holocaust as true, no matter how flawed and even non-existent the evidence for it, what is that doing to our natural recognition of the good and the true? Where will it all end? One thing I can tell you, those who recognize the good and true are considered heretics in our societies today. And I put our in quotes because they are hardly ours. Until next week, this is Carolyn Yeager for the Heretics Hour. Have a good week and do your part in the struggle for truth. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.